welcome in to the latest version of All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast. I am going to promo a couple of things. First, the Doug Gottlieb Show, which runs daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio or the iHeartRadio app. You can follow me on Twitter. We tweet out stuff, and you can listen to pods from the show as well. Secondly, next week on the All Ball Podcast, we'll have a deep dive in with a longtime friend of mine, a guy who I admire greatly. He's the head coach of the Washington Wizards. Scotty Brooks is going to join us. Wait to hear his story. Things that you may not know about Scott Brooks, like what he actually had to do to earn money when he was a kid, how he got to TCU, who he played with at TCU, how he ultimately ended up at UC Irvine as a player. And then we got some minor league stories for you I got to tee up. I want to ask him about finally making the 76ers, living with Charles Barkley early on in his NBA career, all the way until playing for a world championship and playing with the Houston Rockets and Hakeem Olajuwon, what it's like to start games in the NBA from going as a CBA guy back in the day, all the way to becoming a head coach with the Oklahoma City Thunder and now the Washington Wizards. We got stories about KD I got to ask him about. I'm going to ask him about John Wall's picture with USA Basketball. So much to get into. Scott Brooks next week on the All Ball Podcast. It may be so good that, like this one, we'll have to cut it up into two parts. In the meantime, let's dig back in with Jay Billis. If you missed last week, we got some of the early Jay Billis life. I found it fascinating to hear his dad wasn't a basketball guy. Dad was blue collar. His mom said so many different interesting things. Or both, his mom saying, like, hey, if you're complaining about getting the basketball, why don't you, his dad said, like, why don't you go get it when they miss? You know, very matter of fact. And the idea that he went to play for Mike Krzyzewski before Mike Krzyzewski was Coach K, you know, was America's basketball coach. And the reason why he turned down so many other historic programs was he just felt like Coach K was honest. You know, he just felt like Coach K was a guy who did what he said and said what he did. And that struck him. Also, the talk of, you know, the tales of him playing against Ralph Sampson, playing against Michael Jordan. And also, we talked to him about playing against Len Bias, what type of player Len Bias was. All right, so the stuff with Jay was so good, we cut it up into two parts. And look, some of you have been waiting for me and Jay Billis to go at it head-to-head about amateurism. And in this podcast, you'll hear some of that. At the end, I'll kind of circle back and give you a couple of my thoughts. I didn't want to make it an all-out war, an argument over two sides. We simply agree to disagree. You'll hear Jay's side of it. You'll hear a little bit of my side of it. You can discuss with me on social media and what you think. So we'll set up Jay on the NCAA. Does he hate the NCAA? Does he value the NCAA? Why he believes players should be outright paid for their likeness? Should they be able to go straight from high school to the NBA, or should they have to go to college? Plus, I'm going to ask him the question that I really want to know, which is, you got all these different coaches that coached at Duke, played at Duke. Pick one. Who should replace Mike Krzyzewski as Duke's next head men's basketball coach? All right, let's dig into it. Here's Jay Billis from the All Ball Podcast.
Okay, you mentioned Jordan and Sam Perkins. People forget how great a college player Sam Perkins was. They had that incredible team. When you first played against Michael Jordan, when you're playing against him, did you have any sense that he was different, he was more special than all those other talented players in the ACC?
Yes, we played, the first time that I played on the same court with him was in pickup games. So back then, and I don't know what they do now, maybe they do the same thing, but back then, we being the Duke guys would go to Chapel Hill for 2-3 days and play in their gym. They would come to our place for 2-3 days and play in ours, and we would play pickup games. And actually, the only guy that didn't play was Perkins. He did not like playing pickup games. But when you saw him play in those, you're like, whoever said all men are created equal was full of it, man, because that nobody can do this. I'd never seen any that. Honestly, Doug, that was I think you and I may have talked about this when we went to dinner with our wives this summer. That was the first time when, you know, like, if your experience is probably the same. Like, you're growing up in Southern California, you play in high school, and the more work I put in, the better I got. And I really didn't think that there was a limit as to how good I was going to get. And whoever I played against, I felt like I was just as good. And then I got to college and played against, there were three guys I played against where I was going, you know what, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm never going to be as good as those guys. Sampson, Jordan, and Len Bias. Like, those three guys, I was like, I can't, that'll never happen. Like, I can't match that. Didn't mean I couldn't win in the games that we played, and I couldn't be successful. But you're like, that's another gear, and I don't have that gear, and I'll never get it.
I remember.
That was a big deal to come to that realization.
No, I remember when the Thunder, I took my wife to a Thunder playoff game, and we're watching, and I was watching Tony Parker, who I marvel at. I think he's one of the more underrated players in the last 20 years in the NBA. But we were watching Russell Westbrook, and she's like, could you have played in this game? And I was like, yeah, I think I could have played in this game, but I would have no chance against Russell Westbrook. Like, literally no chance. He's just too athletic for. And I was really athletic, but he had another gear. Iverson, I felt like, was, you know, some guys are quick and some guys are fast. He was both, but he was wild, and you could goad him into taking shots that he couldn't make. I remember playing against Ray Allen, but the guy that jumps out to me, I played in the what's now the Jordan game, used to be the Magic's Round Ball Classic, and I replaced Chauncey Billups, got hurt, so I replaced Chauncey Billups. We practiced all week, and Kevin Garnett showed up the day of the game because he took the SAT on a Saturday, and the game was on a Sunday, and he was trying to pass the SAT to play in college. And, like, look, all those guys, Paul Pierce was on my team, and he was a roommate at ABCD, and I remember... it was the first time I saw Vince Carter, who no one could beat in a dunk contest, but Kevin Garnett showed up, and he was just better than everybody else. Like, there was a level to which the top players, the Ron Mercers of the world, were playing, Sharif Abdul-Rahim, and then Kevin Garnett, without practicing at all, playing in the game, you're like, wow, he moves like a guard, only he's 6'10". So I know what you're talking about. What about Len Bias? Like, obviously, you talk about formative things in your life. I remember Hank Gather's death made me scared of heart arrhythmia. I remember that Magic Johnson contracting HIV made me scared of unprotected sex. And I remember Len Bias made me scared of cocaine. The Big East we would see in California on Big Monday, the ACC, I don't remember Len Bias. What was he like?
He was one of the three or four best players I ever saw at that time. And he was 6'8". Built like Superman, and guys' bodies didn't look like this back then. Now it's a little more common because of the nutrition and how they, you know, guys lift weights and all that stuff. He was a natural stud, and you know better than I do. Like, there are certain guys that are powerful leapers that some of the most powerful leapers in the game just aren't good jump shooters. Like, that's those two things often don't go together. And he was maybe the best leaper in the game, especially off 2 feet, and then one of the best jump shooters. Like, he could really shoot it, and we couldn't stop him. He had 41 against us in one game, and we had good defenders, and he put four. You know, we still won the game. That was great, but he was. I think Coach K has actually said this, and I would put Johnny Dawkins in this category, but Coach K had said that the three guys that back then in the 80s that were head and shoulders above everybody else in the league were Sampson, Jordan, and Len Bias. He was unstoppable, and when he got drafted by, like, I thought he was the best player, like, I would have taken him number one, even though Brad Daugherty was number one. That turned out to be a great decision because Brad was an unbelievable player and a great person. But I thought Bias was the best player in our league. And so I thought he was the best player in college basketball, frankly. Like, Walter Berry and Johnny Dawkins shared National Player of the Year that year. But Bias was so much better than Walter Berry, it wasn't funny. And so when he died, I think he died either 1 or 2 days after the 86 NBA draft. And so I was out in California, and my mom told me that he had passed away. I had just woken up, and she said, well, Len Bias died. And I remember that day, for me, that was the equivalent of the Kennedy assassination in my life. That, you know, my parents would always, Kennedy was assassinated a month before I was born. And my parents and all their friends would always talk about where they were when Kennedy was assassinated and when they found out. And I don't think I'll ever forget the one, the feeling, and two, exactly where I was and exactly what was going on when it was like the equivalent now of people saying everybody remembers exactly where they were and what were they were doing when 9/11 happened. Right. And that was that, and even though it's totally different, I'm not trying to equate the things, but that
was the same
type of deal when Len Bias passed away.
No, when we found out, I was a high school freshman. I remember when Magic was going to announce that he had HIV. I remember my high school coach, Tom McCluskey, who played it for Dick Harter at Penn State. He called us all in and he said, you know, Magic Johnson is going to announce that he has HIV. HIV is a virus that leads to AIDS. And he's going to die from this, and you have to take serious, you know, about unprotected sex. I just, like, everybody started crying. Like, I remember that day. I completely and totally get it. You were drafted in the 86 draft, but you never played for the Mavs. Take me through what happened, what it was like back then, being drafted and then going overseas, playing in Italy and Spain.
I got drafted by Dallas, I think, in the fifth round. That was back when there were like six or seven rounds or whatever it was. Maybe there were like eight rounds. And the NBA was probably 25 teams at the time, maybe less than that. Maybe it was 24. Because Mark Price was a second-round pick, and he was like the 24th pick in the draft, something like that. He and Dennis Rodman were second-round picks that year. So I got drafted by Dallas. I went to camp. Dick Motta was the coach, and my draft class was Roy Tarpley was the number one player taken by the Mavs. I think he was taken like six overall or something. And Tarpley was another guy where you're going, you know what, that dude is... Roy Tarpley was a Hall of Fame player. If he could have kept clean on stuff he was doing, he would have been the Hall of Fame. But Dallas was the Pacific Division champion at the time, so they had Rolando Blackman and Ron sure. Harper and Mark Aguirre, you know, James Donaldson, Detlef Schrempf was on the team. And I had thought, okay, well, if I go in there and play really well, there are a couple guys I felt like, well, I think I'm better than these guys. And I found out, like, third day at rookie camp that the Mavericks already had 13 guaranteed contracts and there were only 12 spots on the team. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter what we do here. You know, no, they're not going to cut somebody to put us on the bench to wave a towel around for the Pacific Division champs. So, you know, I went to camp. I thought I played well, and then I got a contract to go overseas, and I played in Italy. And my agent was a guy named Larry Fleischer, who was the former head of the Players Association and represented so many big shots back then. And so he had like interviewed me when I was in college, and it submitted to an interview process. I actually interviewed him. And my dad convinced me, you know, like I was dumb enough to think that some of the younger guys, younger agents, because they could devote more time to me, that's the way I should go. And my dad said, no, he said, go with Larry Fleischer. He goes, I'd rather have a little bit of his time than all of somebody else's time. That turned out to be really smart because, you know, I got a great deal in Italy. I played there my first year. I went back to training camp the following year when John McLeod was the coach. And I just wasn't good enough. Like I was 6'8", and I was a power forward in a league where 6'8" power forwards aren't. You know, I wasn't quick enough to stay in front of a three, and I wasn't big enough to hang with some of the fours in the league. Now, could I have hung on with a team for a little while somewhere? Yes, I think I could have, but with the Mavs, that wasn't going to happen. And they never cut me. I went to camp 3 years in a row, and I was never cut. I always went back overseas before veterans camp was over, and so I was never cut by the Dallas Mavericks. And I mean, it's kind of a weird story, but when I got into broadcasting and I was doing like a Louisville Southern Miss game or something, and I ran into Keith Grant, who was the GM of the Mavericks. He was like the equipment guy when I was there. And he came over, we were talking and having a laugh, and he said, do you know you're still on our active player list? And I'm going, I am? And he goes, yeah, we've never cut you. And I said, well, could you, like, trade me or waive me or something? Like, just waive me in the middle of the season. Like, all my friends would love seeing that. You know, Jay Billis put on waivers in 1996 or whatever it was. But I was never cut by the Mavericks.
Yeah, you could have been part of some, like, trade. You know, there's guys that aren't in the NBA. Keith Van Horn's been part of trades even after he's done playing. You should have hung on to that status. You could have gotten some extra money out of the deal.
They trade those guys and they throw some money at them just to make the money work and all that. That would have been a nice nice way to. But it was. You know, you've been through it, and you were a lot closer to the NBA than I was.
No, I was not. That's not true.
It's been a dream of yours to play, but the good part for me was playing in Italy was a great thing for me because, you know, after going through 4 years of college, and I loved being a role player on the teams I played on and with the guys I played with and the coach I played for. Loved it. But it was kind of cool when I went to Italy and I got to be a star again. You know, you average 20 points a game and all that stuff, and you're among the leading scorers in the league. That was fun again. And so when I quit playing to go be a coach on Coach K's staff after the 89 season, like I had kind of accomplished what I wanted to again. Like I'd go, okay, you know, I got to do what I wanted to do in the game as a player, and it made sense to quit when I quit. Because I thought I'd play 10, 12 years overseas, but for some reason, like the ego boost of being a star again, even though it was Italy and not the NBA, was a nice thing.
So why quit?
I got a job offer. Coach K had called me and said I got an opening on my staff, and I'd like you to take it. And I had told him I wanted to keep playing, and he said, that's fine, but I just don't know that this is going to come around for you again, which, you know, was a nice way of saying, like take this now because I'm not going to offer this to you later. Maybe he would have, I don't know. But I wound up getting into law school right after that, and it was Coach K's idea that I do both. And I honestly, Doug, I think he was pulling the strings on all of it. That you know, he knew I had applied to law school, and so I think it was all kind of part of a plan that he had. That look, you said you wanted to do this. I'm going to help you make it happen. And I told him when I was in high school that I was interested in broadcasting. I didn't know what that meant, but he put me in touch with Duke alums that were involved in it, and I started working during the summertime. And so he really helped me. Kind of get a foothold in the broadcast industry to where I had built up some equity and I learned about it and I met a bunch of people and I worked a bunch of great events and it kind of greased the skids for me to get into it later. And then the whole law school coaching thing, I don't know. I thought I would stay in coaching. But it wasn't the right thing for our family when Wendy and I got married. And so we just decided to go a different direction. I started practicing law, and that's what sort of led to the broadcast thing after that.
All right, we'll get around to that in a second. You're on the staff in 1990. My favorite player was Bobby Hurley. Mm-hmm. And I remember just being devastated. And so many of my friends loved UNLV. You know, UNLV, and this goes back to my dad was an assistant, recruited you some at Long Beach State. And UNLV used to come in, and they were bigger and badder and my dad coached Craig Hodge, was an assistant under Tex Winter, and Craig Hodge was their best player. UC Irvine actually had great players, probably as good or better, more pros maybe than UNLV, and they'd beat UNLV. But UNLV would always win the PCAA. And I remember that 1990 national championship game, and yeah, Bobby was sick and running off to the bathroom, but what was that like to be a part of it? Because there was a bit of a trend there. Going back to when you went to the first Final Four, Coach K, was that Duke would kind of exceed expectations and find a way to get to a Final Four, but you guys couldn't seemingly win a Final Four, win a national championship. You get to the finals in 90 and just get annihilated. What happened?
Yeah, you're right about sort of the feeling. So my senior year in 86, we won 37 games. That was more games won in a single season than any team in the history of the game. And we were the number one team. We got clipped by Louisville by a bucket. And we thought we were better, and we thought we should have won. We didn't. And then the ones they got to after that, maybe 88, 89, 90, probably wasn't the best team, UNLV didn't just beat us, they beat the hell out of us. It was by 30, and it's still, I think it's still the largest margin of victory in NCAA title game history, and it just got away from us. And you know, the kind of the interesting thing, and I learned so much from Coach K in so many different ways, but you know, the next year we wound up facing up against UNLV in the semifinals the following year in 91. And UNLV was undefeated. They had their whole team back. I mean, they were so good, it was ridiculous. And, you know, the staff back then was Pete Caudette, Mike Bray, who's now at Notre Dame, and Tommy Amaker is now at Harvard, and I was the GA. And all the assistants were basically saying, well, there's no need for us to watch the tape of last year's game. You know, we were kind of thinking, why would we show ourselves getting bludgeoned? You know, it was like a cat playing with a mouse in a corner, you know. And Coach K is like, no, we're showing it to them. We're going to show them all the mistakes we made, and if we clean up this, this, and this, we're going to be in the game at the end with a chance to win, and that's where we live. We live in close games. They don't play in any, and we're going to know how to operate, and they're not. And he sold the players on the idea. Like, he showed them everything that they made mistakes on. If we do this better, if we eliminate this, all this stuff. And then he told them, like, we're going to be in this game at the end, and we're going to know how to act, and they're not. And then it happened. You know, it's so brilliant, sort of as a I don't know what you'd call that, motivation, inspiration, whatever it is, but prognostication. But it was amazingly empowering for the players, and even a guy like me sitting on the bench as an assistant watching that. But the year before, man, when that thing started going downhill, and there was no way to stop it, it was, I don't think I've ever felt as helpless in a basketball game as that. That was one of the worst feelings I've ever had. And because you're that close to something you've always wanted. And, I'm still not over my senior year when we lost in the title game. I think about it all. Every time we go to the Final Four to broadcast games and stuff, it eats at me. And it's so different. Like, you know, you've played in the Elite Eight. You know, I played in the tournament before. When you lose before the championship game, I mean, every loss hurts, but nothing hurts more than finishing second. Like, finishing eighth or something, or sixth. That you're not as close. When you finish second, it sucks. It's brutal, and I don't know that I'll ever feel okay about that.
You know, it's interesting. I'm not over the Elite Eight, and I played poorly. We all played poorly. And Florida, if you look at their roster, they were incredible. I can't argue with somebody who actually played in the championship game. I would say that outside of losing in the championship game, the second worst loss is in the Elite Eight, because as you know, being a part of a Final Four team is immortality, right?
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's exactly right.
I remember we were in Syracuse, New York, and Grant Wall was following me around, and he's like, look, if you win this game, you're gonna be on the cover of Sports Illustrated because you got a great story, right? And I remember waking up, like, thinking I'm gonna dream about cutting down the nets. I'm gonna wake up dreaming about it, and I'm gonna make it happen, right? I'm just gonna make it happen, make what I dream happen. And we got down early. Coach got a technical foul. We got down like 13. We came back. We tied the game up. And then Mike Miller hits a three in transition. And like, that was that. We just did not have it. And we didn't have a great game plan. Everybody was involved in the loss. And I remember watching them cut the nets down. And it was like, you're living my destiny. So I can't imagine what that would be like in the national championship game, watching Purvis Ellison, never nervous Purvis, cut down the nets. Yeah, I would say the Elite Eight is the second worst of the losses to the losing championship.
That's a fair point. I mean, and you'd think at our age, look, it's not as sharp a pain as it was the you know, the 6 months afterwards, but it's still pretty sharp. And you'd think at age 54, you know, you kind of go, you know, it's a long time ago. But for some reason, that is a really hard, that's a hard game to lose. And like you're saying about the Final Four thing, you know, like, to be able to, to be able to call yourself a champion for the rest of your life is kind of a nice thing. And yeah. But the funny part, Doug, is that, you know, when, like, I was lucky enough to be on that staff where Duke won back-to-back in 91 and 92. So,
sure.
You know, I tasted sort of the championship win, the national championship wins in those years as an assistant, as a grad assistant. And I think Johnny Dawkins actually had called, when he was in the NBA, had called Tommy Amaker after the 91 championship and said, I think he said something to the effect, does it take it away? And Amaker said, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, it's just different when you're a coach, I think, at least from my seat. Maybe it's different for Coach K being a head coach, but as an assistant, it's not the same. It's not the same feeling. You only get a couple of shots at it, maybe only one as a player. And, you know, Coach K's had 40 shots at this. And he's going to have even more. And so there's just something different about when you're a player as opposed to a coach.
All right. So there's two players I want to ask you. Well, actually, two players I want to ask you about on those back-to-back teams. You added in Grant Hill, and I've come to know him, and I know how close of friends you are, your families are. And there's incredibly special about him as a person that. I don't know if it translates on TV. I don't know if now kids, because of the injuries, the injury that he suffered in the pros, and he still played till he's like 40. But I don't know if people understand how breathtaking a player he was, but also just there is this regal way by which he carried himself, to which you could fall out of the sky and be in a gym and watch him walk in and go, like, I don't know anything about the sport, but that guy is different than the rest of them. Give me to somebody who doesn't understand what made Grant Hill so special as a player, and I know he's still special as a person. What was it?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, on the person front, even though you asked me about the player part, Duke has put out a lot of good guys and a lot of great guys, I should say. Duke's never put out a better guy than Grant Hill. He may be the best person and best sort of full package of person and player that's ever put on any kind of uniform at Duke. And I really believe that. As a player, Grant was he had a humble way of carrying himself, but he's the most gifted basketball player I think to ever play at Duke, and that includes guys like Kyrie Irving and Marvin Bagley III and all these guys that have been higher picks than him. Because I think Grant was like the third pick in the draft when he came out. I think it was Glenn Robinson and Jason Kidd went in front of him, but. Grant's the best player that Duke's ever put out, ever produced, and, you know, could handle it. He was a point guard his senior year. He could guard anybody. He was long. He's athletic. You know, the only thing he couldn't do when he got there, he wasn't a really good shooter, but he became one. And I think we've all seen a lot of this game and you know, think this player's great, that player's great. I've researched this and I saw it up close. Grant Hill's first 7 years in the NBA, there's only five guys in the history of the league that matched his numbers as far as points, rebounds, assists, and steals in the first 7 years in the league. And guys like Magic, Bird, Jordan, Jerry West, Oscar Robertson, guys like that. And, you know, the greats of the great. I happen to believe, like, he's going into the Basketball Hall of Fame in early September, the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. I think he's as deserving as anybody. I look upon Grant Hill as the basketball equivalent of Sandy Koufax, that before he was injured, and his injury almost cost him his life with the staph infection, all the stuff he had to deal with, his first 7 years in the league, he was as good as anybody that's played. I mean, he was that good, and if he stayed healthy, if he didn't have to deal with that horrific injury, he would have it would have been no brainer on Hall of Fame. He would have been with the sort of the Mount Rushmore of players of you know, top 25 guys that have ever played. I think he was that kind of player.
All right, the other side to that is Christian Laettner, mm-hmm. who played in the Dream Team. Had an incredible run his last 2 years, winning, you know, back-to-back national championships. But he had that different sort of edge, right? Like, I grew up, my sister was a UCLA cheerleader. We were season ticket holders. And similarly, Don McLean, and they played against each other, had that kind of same nastiness and edge. I mean, look, he was kind of an asshole when he played. Both of them were. But they were really, really good. To somebody who didn't understand, like, because you look back, you look like Dream Team, you start going through all the guys, and you're like, Christian Laettner, really? What was he like?
Incredibly competitive. And like, Christian's a good guy, and he's smart and all that stuff. But that didn't translate back then because he didn't care as much what other people thought outside the program. He cared what Coach K thought, and he cared what his family thought and all that stuff. And I think he did care what his teammates thought, although he didn't always convey that to them. He was just, all he cared about was playing well and winning. And now maybe I'm forgetting a little thing here or there, Doug, but I don't ever remember him being outplayed. Whether he played Shaquille O'Neal or you name the guys he played against, I don't remember anybody outplaying him. And he was that good. And I thought, honestly, he was going to be a much better pro. This is just my opinion, and I don't know that Coach K or some other people who know him better than I do would agree with this, but he didn't function very well in a losing environment. And so when he went with the Minnesota Timberwolves, that he didn't do well in that environment. But he played a long time in the league, 12 years or so, and averaged like 16 a game for his career. Yeah, he had a good career. He was an All-Star one year when he was with the Hawks. He just played with crummy teams, and I don't think he handled the losing particularly well. Like, he could be abrasive here and there, but I was always a huge fan of his. And personally, as a player, you name it. I remember one time, there are two things about him that I'll never forget. One is, so he's like 6'11", and a great athlete from the standpoint of like, when you and I were kids, athlete meant you could do a whole bunch of things. It didn't mean you could just run and jump.
Right.
So he could walk on his hands, do a handstand, and walk on his hands from baseline to baseline. At 6'11", like, I'd never seen anybody do that. And the other part was, he and I played tennis a few times. And I grew up in Rolling Hills. You know, we had a lot of tennis players there, so I banged the tennis ball around a little bit. I wasn't that good, but on a relative basis. But I could hit with other basketball players and be one of the better players. And that dude could play anything. Like, tennis, he was really good. He's a, like, an expert ping pong player. And he would run your mother over to win.
Yeah.
And I was always really impressed with practice. He was competitive in every drill. You know, guys say they do that, or you always hear that. He really was competitive in every drill, and really hyper aware of his teammates being competitive, and when they weren't doing it, when they weren't living up to what he thought they should be doing, he let them know. And I wasn't around a lot of guys like that, and he was a different breed in that regard.
Okay, so 92, you guys win back to back, and you leave to become a lawyer. You were a criminal defense attorney, right?
No. I never. The only criminal stuff I did was pro bono work. I was I started as a bankruptcy lawyer because I could get into court right away, and honestly, I didn't want to wait my turn as a trial lawyer, as a litigator, because you kind of had to sit second chair and do a bunch of research stuff to get your bona fides. So I went into bankruptcy first because I knew I could be in court all the time, and then I switched over to litigation. I was, litigation is nothing more than sort of essentially a trial lawyer. And so I did commercial litigation and then wound up doing some, securities litigation before I wound up hanging it up after 7-8 years in.
Okay, so, but before you hung it up, how did it come? And you mentioned that during some summers you did some TV stuff. When was the first time you started working for ESPN calling games?
When I had practiced law, it was a decision that my wife Wendy and I made that, you know, the best thing for our family we felt was going to be, let's just live in one place. And you know, if I stayed in coaching, as you know from your experience with your dad and all that, you'd have to move around a lot. And we didn't think that was the best thing for a family. So we just decided for us it was the best thing to, you know, I'd practice law and we'd sort of move on. And I got an offer to do radio games from a guy named George Habel called me and offered me the Duke Radio Network to be a color commentator on doing the radio. And so I thought about it for a little while, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to do this because it's, you know, the money was next to nothing, but I thought it'd be fun, and I thought maybe it could lead to something else. And if it affected my law practice to where it was a problem, I could quit. And so, you know, why would I quit before I started? Let's try it, and if it doesn't work out, I'll quit. And I really enjoyed it. It was hard because of the time it took away. But I started getting in 1995. ESPN offered me some games, and so I started doing games for ESPN, just sort of here and there. And then you know how it is; one thing leads to another. And you know, I got offered a full slate of games, several years later, I got offered they wanted me to leave my law practice and come full time. And so I did that. I figured that with a law degree and having practiced law for several years in my back pocket, if I went into broadcasting, I screwed it up, but I could just start my practice and, you know, go back and start my practice up again. It wouldn't be that hard. And it turned out to be a good decision because, you know, as much as I think I enjoyed practicing law, you know, sitting at basketball games is a hell of a lot more fun.
No question about it. There was the breakthrough I was told with you at ESPN was when you did the women's tournament. And it was your ability to do the research and then to still be you and analyze the game, but while doing the women's game, which showed not just a passion for it, but also an understanding of the work it took. Do you remember what year that was that you first did the women's tournament?
Yeah, it was 2000. At the beginning of the year, if I remember right, you know, the NCAA had complained to ESPN about having professional people doing college, you know, the women's tournament. And so, like, Nancy Lieberman or Rebecca Lobo and folks like that had been, they were so tied with the WNBA, and I was told the NCAA didn't like it, so... I was approached by some of the higher ups at ESPN saying, will you do the women's tournament for us? And I had said, well, if I do that, like, it's a different game. I mean, I got to really work on this and study it. And so I gave back some men's games and I went on the road and I started studying the women's game. And I think you're right, sort of, that was a step forward for me because I had done several years of men's games, but I was doing sort of smaller conferences and all that. And it was a bigger platform, honestly. So when I got to the, you know, I was doing the studio with Robin Roberts and Vera Jones and all that. And then UConn that year beat Tennessee in the final. And it was sort of that was when I knew that, you know what, UConn's not going away. Like, they're the best team now, and they got this recruiting class coming in, and like this. And I had said after the game, like, look, this isn't a fluke. You better get used to this because Tennessee, like, it's not Tennessee anymore. It's UConn, and it's going to be for the foreseeable future. Like, there's been a change. There's been a sea change, and it's over. And that caused some waves when I said that. You know, people didn't say that about Pat Summitt's program. And so, you know, I think I felt confident in what I was talking about, but I think you're right. Like, that was a really fun time. And then I started doing the WNBA. So the WNBA had just started, and I was doing WNBA games too during the summer. And my friends called it the Witness Protection League because nobody watched it back then. But it was really fun. They were all NBA arenas, and we threw a lot of resources at it because we were trying to get the NBA. So it was a fun time, and I really enjoyed all that stuff. But I only did the women's tournament that one year, but really enjoyed it. I worked with great people. It was really fun.
Yeah, no, it was something I actually learned from it, which was. Dave Revson, a friend of both of ours, shared it with me. He said, you know, The lesson there is that while it might not be important to the public, it's important to Bristol. And if you do something well that's important to Bristol, they pay attention. Like I did working with you guys and the game day guys, one day I went on the road was the launch of ESPNU, and I did a month with ESPNU. And that kind of propelled me because no one else was watching ESPNU, but everybody, Mark Shapiro and the guys in Bristol were. And that kind of elevated me in their eyes. And I had a much bigger slate the next year. So I actually took from that and used it in my own career. All right. So then to me, the best, and like, look, Al McGuire probably provided the most color, but I'm not sure if you look back, his analysis was nearly what some of the analysis we hear from people like you today. I know that some people say Al McGuire. I would say the best broadcast team anyone has ever had in college basketball. And I've worked with some of the guys that you work with, but I think you, McDonough, and Bill Raftery, whether it would start in Maui and then it would go through Big Monday. And look, I'm a tough critic, right? And you and I would have it out on some like basketball battles. And I just felt I would learn about basketball, I'd learn about the teams, and I would laugh. I mean, really, really laugh. What was that team like to work? Because that's the best college basketball has ever been broadcast, in my opinion. What was that like?
Saying, and I think that's more about McDonough and Raftery than me. But it was the first time I worked with them. Somebody had the bright idea, which I didn't think was very bright at the time, of dropping me in the middle of their broadcast team. So we had a game at Notre Dame, and Notre Dame had a guy named Danny Miller at the time who had transferred in from Maryland, if I remember right. And so Danny Miller does something great, and Raftery screams out, "It's Miller time, and you know how I love hearing that." And then and McDonough says, "Except on Big Monday, brought to you by Bud Light." And I was like, "All right, I like this." And I felt self-conscious about being there because it was like being dropped in the middle of like the third wheel in a marriage or something. And I'm sitting, I'm lodged between McDonough and Raftery, thinking that they can't be happy about this. And it was, we became, I knew them both very well individually, but we became great friends. And it was more we had fun on the air, but we had more fun off the air. And all we did was hang out, and afterwards we'd go out, and I sort of made the decision back then that that no matter how painful it would be to get up the next morning, I was not going to say no to Bill Raftery. So if he wanted to go out, we're going out, and I'm not going to say, well, I got an early flight, I'm going. And there was more than a few times where I had to drag myself to the airport the next day, and I didn't feel very good, but it was worth every bit of pain that we went through, or that I went through, because I couldn't. My liver is not as strong as his. But we had fun, and I learned a lot from Bill. I think you and I are probably the same way in this, Doug, that if we're accused of anything, we're probably accused of taking the game a little bit too seriously at times. We don't have to make it we're not sending troops to war in this thing. We can kind of relax a little bit more. But Bill has a unique way, and you know him really well. He has fun, and he takes it seriously. He prepares every bit as hard as anybody I've ever worked with. But he loves the game, and more importantly, he loves the people in the game, and he loves the experience of it and being around it. And I learned a lot from him that way, that this is supposed to be fun. And we got into this because it's fun. It doesn't mean it's not serious at times and all that stuff. But we had a blast together. And when Bill went to Fox and left ESPN, I was really happy for him. I was really happy for him as a friend, because and he's in the later stages of his career. For him to be celebrated the way he is right now is really heartwarming for me, because I think it should have been this way all along. But there was, from a selfish standpoint, when that meant we weren't going to be working together, there was a sadness to it that I still haven't gotten quite over. But just seeing him be celebrated this way, and Emmy wins and all that stuff, It was too long a time in coming, and nobody deserves it more, because there's not been a nicer person that's worked in the broadcast industry than Bill, and there's not a more talented individual in the big moment than Sean McDonough. It was an honor, and still is, for me to work with Sean, but it was an honor to be in that trio.
Yeah, I feel bad for Sean, though. I feel like, the Monday Night Football thing didn't work, and I feel like some of that was that, you know, you parachute in there with Gruden, and he didn't have the chemistry that he has with you or that he had with Raft, and it's pretty obvious when you put the right mix together. He's an outstanding game caller, as good as anybody in the business. Look, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about amateurism. You and I whether when we work together or now Twitter or various shows, we have obviously the opposite opinion of it. But I think many people view your approach to it as, you know, one, you don't like the NCAA, and then two, you think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you think that amateurism is kind of a sham. How would you characterize kind of your feelings first about the NCAA and whether or not that organization is fixable?
Well, first, I don't dislike the NCAA. I dislike some of the policies. And I think there are, you know, while some people use the term hypocrisy, I try to use the term contradiction. They contradict themselves all the time with their policies. My thing has always been about policy rather than people. There are great people at the NCAA. There's so many of them that are my friends. So we may differ on, kind of like you and I may differ on an issue of policy. I don't think you and I differ all that much. My thing is simply, we're in a multi-billion-dollar business here, and the athletes should have the same economic rights as everybody else. And, the way I have understood your position is, like, look, the athletes get enough and wait your 4 years and then you can go, make money later on. And it's if you don't like it, go somewhere else. You know, that this is all legitimate and okay and all that. If I've made a mistake there, jump in. But what I would say in response is kind of, that's a great way to do it at your school. Like, if you don't believe at your school that you should pay, then don't pay. Similarly with coaches or facilities and all that, each school makes their own decisions on how to do that. Like my school, where I went to school, they're paying Coach K $8-9 million a year. That's great. I have no problem with that. I just don't believe that the players should be sort of restricted to their expenses only. And while I hear Mark Emmert and folks within the structure say, well, they're students, like as if that's dispositive of the issue. And my thing is, well, wait a minute. What other student do you tell that you can't make your fair market value in whatever field of endeavor you choose? There's no other student that they say, well, you're a student, so you can't make money. And you can't be an employee of the university, and you can't be. It's the athlete is the only one, and so while folks say, well, hey, you have a choice. If you don't like it, don't play. I tend to look at it that, well, why don't the schools have the choice? They should have the choice that if you don't want to pay, don't pay. Or if you want to pay less, pay less. Or if you want to go Division II, go Division II. I tend to think that if you're in the Division I arena and you're selling these players for all this money, the players should be allowed to benefit from it. Is there a middle ground? Can we do name, image, and likeness, all that? I'm sure there are middle grounds. But I wind up starting with the sort of the idea that, like, look, this is big money. This is big money stuff. The players should be allowed to do this. And absent a compelling reason why they shouldn't, why they shouldn't be allowed to have the same economic rights as literally everyone else, literally every other student, literally every other person, why should the athlete be the only one restricted industry-wide by a cartel rule? I don't get that. But individual schools, if they don't want to pay, or if some schools want to pay more, I'm all for it, just as I am with facilities and coaching salaries and travel and all that other stuff. I say let the schools make their own decisions.
I see. I'm not necessarily an absolutist in terms of you do it this way or you're gone or go do something else. I do think that one of the things is undersold is, look, there is the opportunity for players to come straight to high school, go to the G League for a year, and then put their name in the NBA draft. And to this point, no one's done it, right? There was the kid that was going to go to Syracuse, but now he's not doing the G League this year. Anyway, my feeling is actually it's almost like a salary cap, right? Like the underrated part of the salary cap is not that there's a ceiling, but that there's a floor. And I do actually think that players are compensated. They're compensated with all of the benefits of scholarships, but also compensated in terms of the promotion, the kind of endless, ceaseless promotion that that both of us are a part of, right? That's what we do. We educate the American public and, frankly, their future fans on these players at a very young age, right when they come to college, and being tied to the name of the university, the image of the college coach, they used kind of that. They use the branding of the school and of the coach to kind of be promoted within the sport. And I think there's a value there. I also think there's a value to simply being admitted to school. Like I couldn't have gotten to Notre Dame on my own then, let alone now with my grades when I was in high school. I had no chance of getting in, especially as you know, putting kids through school, how difficult it is just to get into many of these schools. So I don't think it's as much cut and dry. Hey, if you don't like it, you know, be gone with you. I actually think there's a lot more value in for the floor, for the non-one percenters. And that's who we're protecting, even if there's a couple of guys that could make a couple of dollars off their name and likeness. Is that fair? And the other part is that I look at it as, hey, all these colleges, they're making money off of all of their students. You talk about they're actually making money off of all of their students, whether it's the research they do or simply the admission that they pay for. Athletes are no different, and making money off of students we're only more aware of what they make off of students because of the TV rights. We're not aware of what they make off of the grants and the other things that they make off of the research of the students that isn't as publicized.
Yeah, those are fair points, but I would argue that your points on the value side, when you say, okay, they're getting this value and that value and all that, those are all fair points. But to me, my argument would be, well, if they're so valuable, let those things stand on their own in the marketplace. Because you could certainly make the same argument that, you know, coaches are allowed the same platform and have all these other, you know, they get all these other benefits from working in this industry, and they wouldn't be as coveted. They're, you know, the 1% wouldn't be as coveted, or those outside the 1% wouldn't be as coveted on the NBA level. But yet they're making millions of dollars because the college market is its own separate and distinct market. So one's value in the NBA is not reflective of one's value in the college market. And your point about, you know, other students and you know, they're having money made off of them, they're not restricted by an industry-wide rule. So every other student, they're subject only to the rule of their university. There's no industry-wide rule that keeps everybody from being paid above a certain level. And I hear you on the like when you say that you know you feel that the players are compensated. Well, I agree with that. They are compensated, but it's capped. So on one hand, they say they're students, they're not employees. But then on another hand, we make the argument that they are compensated. Look at what they're getting. And they do get things, but really what they get more than anything is they get limited. And no other student is limited in any regard across the board. And so, like, look, it's a fundamental difference that we have.
Yep.
And I don't think it's any sort of craziness on either person's side. Like, I don't look at that argument. Like, I have this argument with Reese Davis every once in a while. Well, he'll say, now, at the end of the day, it is a choice. Like, the players have a choice. I don't happen to agree with him. I don't think when you have a collusive cartel restriction within a market, that's a choice at all. It's a false choice. I'm always asking, like, why is the choice being put on the athlete? Why isn't the choice on the part of the university? Like, why can't why isn't the university choosing to pay or not, and how much? You know, they don't have that choice. That choice is taken away from them, or they give it away in colluding together to limit athletes. And I get why they do it. I get why they make the arguments they're making, because they can keep all the money, and they don't want to pay. I don't want to pay my employees. Like, we have people that work on our house. I don't want to pay them if I don't have to, but you have to, and it's the right thing to do. And if this were run like Division II or Division III, you wouldn't hear anything from me. But it's not. It's a big business. Will the world collapse if this goes on this way? No. But I don't think it would collapse either if Jeffrey Kessler in the Jenkins case, if Jenkins wins in California in the Ninth Circuit, in the case that's going to trial soon, and the NCAA is forced to allow pay, you know, I don't think the world's going to spin off its axis. I think we're going to do just fine. And I'll leave you with this one on the unless you want to keep talking about certain things. But when I was in college in the 80s, if I had gone to a Duke alumni event and said, you know what, someday, you know, Coach K was probably making, when I was playing, no more than $100,000. If I had said to all the Duke alums back then at one of these alumni events, you know, someday we're going to pay him $8, $9, $10 million a year, they would have said, nope, never happened. That's not what college sports is about. We'll never do that. That's not Duke. And they're doing it. And they're consuming it and loving it. And they fly around on private planes. They have gigantic facilities. It's professional in every way. And I have zero problem with it. It's great. But the stuff they said that they would never do, they're doing. And while everybody says, like, everything would crumble, you're not saying this, but, the NCAA does say this, that demand for the game would diminish if the players were provided more than if they were paid. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that. I don't know any reasonable economist that agrees with that. And everything else that college sports does flies in the face of that argument. We'd be just fine if the players were paid. I don't believe that for one second. But reasonable minds can differ on these things, and I don't have any problem with somebody who sees it differently than I do.
My fear is not whether or not they pay him or not. I do have a legit concern about the state of the game. It appears that the NBA is going to go back to the, you know, you can come straight out of high school. It appears that seems to be a formality. And as much as there are a couple of kids who can kind of make the jump and within a couple of years, be good enough, you and I both know that if there's five that can make it, there's 55 or so that think they can make it. You combine that with the fact that every game is on TV, my network, your network, the network both of us used to spend some time with at CBS. They broadcast games. NBC has some. It's we've kind of been polluted. There's games on every day. There's nothing special about a TV game like there used to be. Like Big Monday used to be it. You were on Big Monday. You're on national TV. Vital was there. Billis is there. That was it. That was the biggest game. It's not as much that way. There's more NBA games on now. So even your big Saturday night games, which used to be it, there's also, you know, on ABC, you got NBA basketball. I am concerned about the future of college basketball. You know, a lot of college basketball coaches want the baseball rule. Stay for 3 years, go straight out of high school, or stay for 3 years. My problem is, doesn't that make college basketball college baseball, where people don't really care nearly as much? That's my concern with the state of game, even more so than whether or not we pay players.
Yeah, and that's legit. And I do think, at least in my years in the game, we have become, in large measure for the rank and file sports fans out there, we've become basically a 1 or 2 month sport. And, you know, we're never going to be able to compete with college football or the NFL as long as this train keeps running down the tracks the way it is. Maybe concussions change that. I mean, I don't think concussions are, you know, so this concussion issue is going to greatly threaten the NFL because it's professional. But it's an existential problem for college football, because I don't see how the NCAA can, if this concussion stuff comes out the way I think it will, where normal contact in a football game is going to be proven to lead to brain injury, that that, you know, college can say with a straight face that for money we are going to scramble the brains that we're supposed to be educating. So does basketball do better as a result? I don't know the answer to that, but we can't compete with football right now, and I don't think we should worry about it. The problem I have, Doug, is that, you know, I think you and I are the same in this, that, you know, I believe in education. I think the best thing for any young person is to stay in college as long as they can, and not for basketball or whatever sport. And if they do leave, that they should come back, and they should be welcomed back, and we should encourage them to come back, because it's important. And for me, I think sort of the NCAA attitude comes off as being, if you don't want to do it our way, then be off with you and we don't care. And, you know, sort of this blaming the one and done rule for all of our problems, whether it's the FBI thing or you name it, I think is wrong. That one and done is not the blame for all this stuff. And if the NBA gets rid of the one and done rule and college or players can go out of high school again like they did, you know, from 95 to 05, whatever it was, we're still going to have one and done players because we've got all these players reclassing. So they're just going to reclass and get into college earlier and skip their senior year of high school and go to college and still be gone after 1 year. So we're still going to have all these same problems because the NBA is not going to put in, as far as I know, there's no appetite for them to put in a two-year rule or the baseball rule. That's not going to happen because the Players Association will never agree to it. And this stuff, I want to wait and see how it comes out, but this stuff where with USA Basketball and the NBA collaborating on, you know, picking the best players and sort of, you know, the model of what, you know, these European academies, especially in soccer, we seem to be headed that way. What is that going to do to the player that's just outside of that cut line? You know, are they going to say, wait a minute, these guys don't know how good I am, I'm leaving, and they make a mistake? You know, are we going to welcome them back? How are we going to take care of all this stuff? And what are we going to do with, who's going to be in charge of these players, and what's going to keep colleges from hiring them? You know, we say we don't like the AAU guys, and we want to get it back into the high schools. Where do you think the AAU guys are going to, not you, but where do you think the AAU guys are going to go? They're going to go to high school. Right. And where do you think if the shoe companies aren't sponsoring AAU teams, who do you think they're going to sponsor? They're going to sponsor the high schools. Right. And we're going to go right back. We're going to have the same system in sort of a different time frame. And we're not going to stop the flow of money. I just don't believe that can happen. The money, it's kind of like that line from Jurassic Park where Jeff Goldblum's character says, life finds a way. And money will find a way. And I really believe that. I don't mean to sound that cynical about it, but I don't think we're going to make a couple of changes from Condoleezza Rice's commission, and all of a sudden we're going to figure this out. I just don't think it's going to work that way. We've had this going on a long time. Like, people cheated when I was in school. Nobody was eligible when I played strictly. Somebody took something. Everybody took something. And I don't think there are very many players, honestly, very many good players that are eligible now. These rules are impossible to live by in a normal society with normal human behavior. They're impossible. And we're fooling ourselves if we think that any team that's won a national championship and played in the Final Four and all that didn't have an ineligible player on their roster. They all have. And we'd be foolish to think otherwise.
Yeah, I use a different Jurassic Park reference. I reference Raptors. I feel like coaching high school and college players, they're like Raptors. Remember when they explained that every day they test a different part of the fence, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it's like to raise. That's what it's like to raise kids, right? They every day they test you, but they test a different part of the fence. They learn, right?
They leave as big a pile of feces around as those dinosaurs did.
Last thing, you've been more than gracious with your time. What else do you want to do? Like, you've done a lot. You're in your early 50s. Your kids are now going to be off, and as you and your wife, you guys, we shared a dinner, and it was great. Wendy's incredible. But now you
Angie
can...
Angie is, too. I don't know what you did to get her, but it's probably illegal.
Yes, it actually is. I'll give you the substance sometime offline. But what, you know, there's been talk of, hey, do you want to head up college basketball? You did coach. You've been a lawyer. You've broadcasted NCAA tournament games. The top guy at you have your pick of games at ESPN. What you got 40 years left here at least on this soil. What else you want to do?
That's a good question. I've not really thought that way in a long time. I can tell you at my age now, I'm 54. My kids are just about to get my youngest out of college this May. My biggest focus is that my wife gets to do what she wants to do. She's put a lot of time into doing what other people want to do, whether it's me or our kids. And so whatever she wants to do, that's going to be priority number one. Like on the front of the game, like I enjoy the heck, like you do, enjoy the heck out of my job. I can't imagine leaving it. It's pretty low stress, and it's all kinds of fun. The only stress I have is travel. But I've always wanted to help, and I've always, you know, any time there's been a committee, you want me to sit on a committee, I'll sit on it. You want me to do that, I'll do it. You want me to show up, I'll show up. So if there's a legitimate thing that I could do to help the game, I'll do it. You know, I hear this commissioner talk. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But I will, like, if the NCAA structure, if the game, anywhere in the game, if I can help, I am willing to help. But I'm not looking to sort of get into another job where, you know, I'm an NBA GM or something like that. Like, I'm not jonesing for that kind of thing. I will never say never as to any opportunity, because I think it, you know, you never know. Like, I think I've always felt like in whatever job you're in, like at some point we are all going to get kicked to the curb, and very few people get to walk away from whatever they're doing, you know, sort of at the highest level. And so, like, I fully understand that maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, I have no idea, but I'm going to get kicked to the curb. And I feel like I can do other things. If I get kicked to the curb, I'll figure something out. But right now I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and I'm not looking around. And I've always felt like the best way to get a job is do the job you have. And I've been doing the job I have, and I like it. So I'm not really looking. But your question about, you know, kind of what do you want to, I'm willing to help in whatever capacity, as much or as little as people in charge may need. And so I'm completely open to that, but I'm not looking for it.
Okay, I said that was my last one, but since you're looking to help, let's say Coach K calls you up on the phone and he says, "I need you to come down to Durham. It's very, very important." You come down, he says, "All right, I got this list here. I got Bobby, I got Tommy, I got Doc, I got Wojo, I have Collins. Quinn's doing an amazing job with the Jazz. I mean, not discussed enough is how good a coach Quinn Snyder has become."
That's exactly right. I just saw him a couple days ago. He's as great as Brad Stevens is. Yeah. I'm not sure he's any better than Quinn Snyder.
I'm not sure
I believe he is. I think Quinn, among the young coaches, he's at the top of the game with anybody.
I went to the Clippers series 2 years ago when they beat the Clippers in seven, and I went to two different games, and I sat there with Colin Cowherd, a colleague of mine. I was like, Quinn Snyder is a hellaciously good basketball coach. They get exactly what they want in every key situation. And then you got Capel, who got another job with Pitt. Who's the guy? Who should be the guy?
That's a great question, and I'm going to sound like I'm dodging it, but I don't think I am. I don't know. Because I don't know how much longer Coach K is going to go. I think, Doug, if you'd asked me this 5 years ago, like, how much longer is Coach K going to go, I would have said, well, you know, another 5 years. And I feel like it's going to be another 5 years from now. I think the only thing that gets him out of basketball is going to be a health problem. I went on that trip that they took to Canada in early August, or August 13th, whatever it was. And his energy level is really high. But the difference this year is he can move. He was out on the court coaching, and I haven't seen him move like that in easily 10 years. I mean, he was all over the court, and he was not like that the last 2-3 years. You know, I think this is right. Like, from April 2016, I think I read this somewhere, April 2016 to now, he's had six different surgeries. But he's healthy now, and physically healthy, mentally healthy, you name it. He's in a great spot. So, like, all the guys you named, whether it's Tommy Amaker or Johnny Dawkins, I don't think Quinn Snyder is going to leave the NBA, but who knows? Who knows what would happen? That's going to be, I don't think this is hyperbole, and I don't think it's coming from, like, this deep-seated, you know, Duke Blue running through veins of mine or all that. I think replacing Coach K is going to be the toughest act to follow in the history of college sports, and maybe up there in the history of sports. Like, he's been doing this at that school for, I think this is year 39, and all of it has been on television. All of it. Like, John Wooden didn't play on television like this. And Bear Bryant didn't play on television like this. I even think it's going to be a harder act to follow than Saban. As great as Saban's been, maybe the best football coach ever in college. And arguably, in you know, you can put him up with any NFL coach. I don't know. But I think this is going to be the hardest act to follow ever. And I don't know that who I'd wish that on. I think it's going to be a really, really hard deal. But there are a lot of good candidates, and I don't know, honestly, last thing, I don't know that I would limit it to Duke people. Because, you know, you've seen this every bit as much as I have. Like, the icons that are being replaced and have been replaced in college basketball, they weren't from the family that they created. So why does the next guy have to be from the family? Just get the, the best guy.
Well, Roy was. I mean, Roy's the one guy, and he's finally. And look, it took him a while to get around to that. But they bought Roy home, and that clearly has worked. And that's
a good point. But that's an extraordinary happening.
You know, I understand. But okay, let's.
That's like the outlier, isn't it? Like, who else have we had? You might have had a Gene Stallings, you know, comes from the Bear Bryant tree and wins a national championship, but it wasn't like he was there that long. You don't have icon replacing icon that often. That's an extraordinary happening, and somebody's got to take the job after Coach K. But man, that is going to be a bear of a task. And look, I know there are people that are up to it and they'll do great. But man, that is going to be a tough act to follow.
I can't tell you how thankful I am to one have gotten to hang out with you and Wendy next year. You're going to allow us to pick up the tab when you're in our hometown. But then all the time you spent with us tonight, I really, really appreciate it. And I'm happy to call you a friend. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the time that you spent with us here on this podcast.
Well, that's a deal, brother. Looking forward to it. And please tell Angie we said hello.
All right. We'll see you down the road in college basketball season. And thanks for being our guest.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Doug.
That's Jay Billis, of course, of ESPN, their lead college basketball analyst. I could give you wrap-ups, or I could sit here and point to things. But I'll allow you to tweet about it, obviously breaking it down into two different parts because of its length. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Two guys from similar sort of area, different sort of backgrounds, but both of us love ball. Hoped you loved all ball. Wow, Jay Billis was incredibly gracious with his time. Feel free to tweet at him, to tweet at me, your thoughts on the podcast. And remember, Scott Brooks next week. And he has great stories. But my sincere gratitude and thanks to Jay spending so much time talking about him, talking about Raf, talking about what it was like to play, what it's been like to cover, and his own future and his thoughts on Duke and college basketball, NBA basketball, a sport that we love, and that's kind of brought us together as friends. Hope you enjoyed listening. Remember to subscribe, download, and rate us, and tune in next week to Scott Brooks, the head coach of the Washington Wizards. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This has been All Ball.